The Successors, written by Luke Mahler and produced by Chris Brown.
Hello, I'm Luke Mahler, and this is the second installment of the Successors podcast. Last time, we observed as Perdiccas rose to power as regent and weathered the initial upheavals following Alexander's death, only to be immediately challenged by Greek freedom fighters in both East and West. The revolt in the West had, if you recall, led to a shocking Greek victory over the field army of Antipater. Trapped inside the fortress of Lamia, the old general could only watch helplessly as the brilliant Athenian commander Leosthenes prepared his forces for an all-out assault. Yet, as Perdiccas sat upon his shaky throne in Babylon, he knew he couldn't afford to spare a single soldier to suppress the Greek rebellion. After all, he was now facing a Greek rebellion of his own, and one that seemed to be every bit as formidable as Leosthenes' coalition in the West. Last episode, I briefly touched on this revolt, but to call the Greek uprising in Bactria a revolt demeans its sheer scale. Considering the size of the rebel army and the goals of its commanders, the word migration might give a better description. The rebel forces now stood at over 20,000 infantry and 3,000 cavalry. They had elected a competent mercenary captain named Philon of Aenania as their supreme commander. This was as formidable an army as could be found anywhere in the eastern reaches of the empire. Alexander had settled these men in Bactria, modern-day Afghanistan, both to plant a seed of Hellenic culture in the wilds of Central Asia and to control the fierce, independent-minded Bactrian tribes. The Macedonian commanders had likely envisioned this army skirmishing with Bactrian bandits and warding off invasions by the nomads to the north. But now, they would have to face it in pitched battle. The Greeks had always hated the land in which they were forced to make a new home, with its alien customs and incomprehensible languages. They longed for their relatives and friends in Greece, and with Alexander gone, they saw no reason to live as barbarians when they could end their exile by force of arms. As Xenophon proved, no man fights like the man fighting to return home. Observing the progress of this dangerous force, Perdiccas knew he would have to move quickly. There was no question of simply gathering the imperial army and meeting the rebels in pitched combat. That army was a shell of its former self, dispersed between dozens of ambitious generals and satraps. Even the portion that remained to Perdiccas had been split. A significant detachment had been sent with Eumenes to conquer the stubbornly independent ruler of Cappadocia in Asia Minor. Hard-pressed as he was, Perdiccas was only able to muster 3,000 infantry and 800 horsemen for the eastern campaign, a force which paled in comparison to the rebel army. But Perdiccas did not despair. Even if he had insufficient forces in Babylon, he knew where he could muster more. The eastern satrapies were vast, and Macedonian garrisons were scattered across the eastern cities in large numbers. In addition, the satraps would be able to provide native levies to supplement the imperial army, if, of course, they could be persuaded to do so. Perdiccas' grip on the empire was, as we have seen, extremely tenuous. There was no guarantee that the satraps would merely acquiesce to his orders. Perdiccas would need a general capable of both defeating the rebels and of keeping the eastern satraps in line. And luckily, he knew he had just the man for the job. He offered the job to a man named Pathon, who agreed immediately and enthusiastically. Pathon was, even then, famous among the Macedonians for his personal valor, charisma, and elan. Perdiccas had recognized Pathon's potential early on. He received the important satrapy of Media at the beginning of the partition of Babylon, at the same time as Ptolemy, Lysimachus, and the rest received their own lands. In Pathon, Perdiccas could be confident that he had found a man who could inspire loyalty in the eastern marshals and defeat the foe head-on. Like so many, too many, of Perdiccas' subordinates and nominees, however, Pathon had ulterior motives. He knew he would have what amounted to a free hand in the east. Perdiccas was preoccupied with his own troubles in the west, in Cappadocia and among the generals. He had sent out a letter to all the satraps of the east, ordering them to obey Pathon as supreme commander and exhorting them to levy 10,000 infantry and 8,000 cavalry to join his army. Pathon would be second only to Perdiccas himself, with authority over every general and magnate from Media on eastwards. To top this, Pathon didn't ever intend to destroy the Greek rebellion, as Perdiccas had ordered. Here, we get a glimpse of Pathon's character. He firmly rejected any suggestion of harsh reprisals against the rebels. Why slaughter Greeks, Pathon wondered, men who only wanted to see their homes again? Pathon had no quarrel with these men, and he saw no reason why they shouldn't be treated generously. After they had submitted to his authority, of course. Beyond any moral concern, Pathon believed that if he treated the rebellious Greek army well, he might actually be able to induce it to join him. And, with the might of all the Eastern Empire, plus the Greek forces, he planned to turn west and topple Perdiccas from his throne. In Pathon's mind, no man should rule but Pathon. But, as we have seen, despite the general disloyalty of Perdiccas' generals, soldiers, friends, peers, and, well, pretty much everyone associated with him, Perdiccas himself was not a fool. He had given Pathon express orders to butcher every last Greek. He guessed at Pathon's intention and knew none of the rebels could be left alive to add to Pathon's power. Pathon pledged to be faithful and obey Perdiccas' orders to the letter, though of course he didn't for one second intend to do so. What could Perdiccas do? He'd be 1,000 miles away in Babylon, and Pathon could do as he liked. As Pathon marched east from Babylon, the Grand Army began to coalesce around the corps of soldiers Perdiccas had given him. As he marched toward Bactria, his forces swelled until he commanded a force outnumbering the rebels by several thousand. Philon and his Greeks were, however, undaunted. After all, how many times had the might of free Greece triumphed over force of numbers? They marched confidently to meet Pathon, and when the two armies encountered one another, battle was joined almost immediately. The combat raged on for a long while without either side gaining a decisive edge. Pathon's superior cavalry were counterbalanced by the more numerous rebel infantry, and the Macedonian army found itself unable to break the Greek line. The Greeks fought on with courage until Pathon played his trump card. A commander in the Greek ranks took 3,000 men and fled to a nearby hill. Immediately, disorder set in amongst the Greek army. Pathon had used the familiar trick of Macedonian commanders facing Greek coalitions. He'd broken apart the enemy army with bribery and intrigue. Despite the bravery of the Greeks, despite the resolve of their captains, there was inevitably a man willing to betray his comrades. Pathon had, after all, offered excellent terms. And, to the defeated Greeks' surprise, he offered those terms to them as well. He urged them to return to their garrisons in Bactria, and swore that he would take no reprisals against them. In return, he asked for oaths of loyalty and obedience. The Greeks, relieved to be let off so lightly, accepted gratefully. Pathon was elated. Everything was proceeding as he foreseen. Until, to his horror, that detachment of Macedonian soldiers provided to him by Perdiccas turned on the disarmed Greeks and cut them to pieces. Defenseless and convinced they'd already made peace with the Macedonian army, the Greeks were caught by surprise and were butchered down to the last man. As Pathon gazed at the field of carnage, he had to have reflected on how badly Perdiccas had outwitted him. Pathon had thought to use Perdiccas' resources to build a following for himself in the east. Instead, Perdiccas had used Pathon's talent for command to destroy his own personal enemies. Pathon had neglected to consider that the 3,000 infantry and 800 horsemen Perdiccas loaned to him might, in fact, retain their loyalties to Perdiccas above all other men. When Pathon ordered the Greeks to be spared, they remembered this loyalty and followed Perdiccas' orders instead. Pathon was, in spite of this setback, still a victorious general. Yet, as he marched back to Babylon, his grand army melting away as each satrap returned to his stronghold, Pathon's triumph must have seemed hollow indeed. Once again, despite powerful external enemies and conniving internal threats, Perdiccas had successfully dealt with another crisis with no civil war and no military defeat. Even if his position remained shaky, his competence and even brilliance could not be doubted. But even in the midst of triumph, Perdiccas had precious little time to celebrate. His gaze had, of late, fallen upon one of the last remnants of the old Persian order, the stubbornly defiant satrapy of Cappadocia. The arid plateaus of the east-central Anatolian country had avoided conquest as Alexander's army swept eastwards towards its duel with the Persians, and a native ruler named Ariarathes had taken advantage of the chaos caused by the Hellenic invasion to declare himself the first king of Cappadocia. His claims were not hollow. He had a formidable force at his disposal, which he had used to expand his new kingdom and even to battle against Alexander himself at Gaugamela. He'd sparred with Antigonus One Eye and managed to come out of the conflict with his army and kingdom still intact. But Perdiccas could not brook an independent Persian monarch threatening such an integral part of the new Macedonian Empire. Ariarathes and his forces were in a perfect position to cut off Macedon's possessions in Greece and Western Asia Minor from the east, if defenses in the region ever faltered. Perdiccas had, if you recall, earlier dispatched a detachment of the imperial army under Eumenes to the region of Cappadocia. Eumenes was to serve the dual purpose of keeping Antigonus and his ilk in line and of conquering Cappadocia once and for all. In the aftermath, Eumenes would take his place as satrap of the conquered lands, and Perdiccas would have a strong, valuable, and well-rewarded ally in control of the strategically crucial region. Perdiccas soon planned to join Eumenes with considerable forces, and had sent orders to Antigonus One Eye and Leonidas, a former bodyguard of Alexander and current satrap of Hellespontine Phrygia, to meet up with Eumenes and crush the Cappadocians. However, neither man was prepared to meekly submit to Perdiccas' dictates. Antigonus flat-out ignored the orders, and Leonidas rejected them in favor of his own personal ambitions back in Europe. Leonidas did meet with Eumenes, and tried to tempt him into joining him in his march westwards. Together, the two of them could join with Antipater, crush the Greek rebellion, and afterwards, perhaps it was time for a new king to be crowned in Macedon. But Eumenes rejected Leonidas' offer, sure that Antipater, who hated him passionately, would order him put to death as soon as he arrived in Greece. When night fell, Eumenes took his small force and rode hell for leather to the camp of Perdiccas. He told Perdiccas everything, Antigonus' disloyalty, Leonidas' royal ambitions, and the dire situation Perdiccas' regime now faced. The regent was unshaken, however. He raised as large an army as he could muster and invaded Cappadocia immediately. King Ariarathes, who had for so long held his own against the Macedonians, had finally met his match. His forces crumbled before Perdiccas' army with rapidity, and he himself was taken prisoner. Eumenes took possession of Cappadocia. Plutarch mentions that Eumenes' closest and most trusted friends and subordinates were made administrators of the various cities. As Perdiccas prepared his army to depart Cappadocia, Eumenes expected to join him, but to his surprise, Perdiccas asked him to remain in Cappadocia. Officially, Eumenes would govern the region and consolidate the new conquests. But Perdiccas' real intention was far less prosaic. He commanded Eumenes to keep a close eye on the satrapy of Armenia, to the east of Cappadocia. The satrap there, Neoptolemus, was dangerously independent, and certainly far from loyal to Perdiccas' regime. Eumenes was to use what little forces he had to constrain Neoptolemus, and, if at all possible, keep him loyal. A Herculean task, to be sure, but one Perdiccas was confident his ally could accomplish. But while Perdiccas consolidated his control in the east, Antipater struggled to do the same in the west. We left Antipater and the Macedonians in dire straits. The brilliant Athenian general Leosthenes had defeated them and trapped them in the fortress of Lamia in central Greece. They were completely encircled, but Leosthenes was not merely content to starve them out. He established massive fortified camps around the city and drew up his forces in full battle array outside the walls. Leosthenes challenged Antipater to lead out his men and meet the Greeks in valorous, honorable combat. But Antipater prudently, if unheroically, declined. Strong walls, he decided, were of more use than blind gallantry. His judgment soon proved to be correct. Leosthenes ordered countless assaults on the walls of Lamia, with ladders, ditches, rams, and every trick in his arsenal. But Lamia was a strong city, and Antipater had fortified it extremely effectively. The Macedonians repelled every assault, and Leosthenes soon had to give up any hope of taking the city by naked force. He resolved to fall back on starving Antipater out. And, as the weeks and months passed, his strategy began to work. The Aetolians, firm allies of Leosthenes, had asked his permission to return to their homes and deal with some troubles that had arisen back in Aetolia. Leosthenes granted their request, confident that even his forces alone could handle the starving and broken Macedonians in Lamia. As morale in the city worsened, and danger of outright famine increased, it seemed he might be right. But suddenly, fate intervened. During a chance skirmish around some field fortifications, a Macedonian missile struck Leosthenes on the head. He was rushed back to camp, and was given all possible medical assistance, but to no avail. On the third day after he was wounded, Leosthenes of Athens breathed his last. He had done great things for his city. More, he had done great things for the Greeks. By his resolve, leadership, and military skill, he had almost single-handedly breathed life back into the cause of Hellenic freedom. And when he died, that life left the cause with him. His mourning countrymen gave him a hero's funeral, with the famed orator Hyperides giving his funeral oration. The Greeks already regretted the loss of their great general, but as the war continued, they would come to regret the loss yet more. For in the east, storm clouds were gathering. Leonidas may have failed to persuade Eumenes to join his march westwards, but even by himself he presented a formidable threat to the Greek coalition. And this was before Leosthenes fell. Now, deprived of their great leader, the Greeks were in a precarious position. The historian Diodorus notes that the Greeks immediately appointed a man named Antiphilus to supreme command. Though Diodorus calls him a man of outstanding courage and military genius, it soon became painfully clear that he was no proper replacement for the truly brilliant Leosthenes. Still, he was no fool, and he knew that he could not hope to stand against the vast forces available to the Macedonian generals in the east. But he had reason to hope it might not come to an all-out land battle. As in so many Greek wars, the Athenians had deployed their mighty navy to supplement their insufficient land forces. The Athenian fleet, near 200 strong, was formidable, certainly large enough to prevent any Asian crossing. Leonidas planned to cross at the Hellespont, following the footsteps of Xerxes. But, unlike Xerxes, he knew that he couldn't simply build a makeshift bridge and walk right across. He would first have to defeat the Greek fleet. But luckily, he would not have to fight it alone. His friend, fellow general, and subordinate Craterus was nearly as famous and popular as Leonidas himself. And it was to this charismatic officer that Leonidas turned. Before Alexander died, he'd entrusted General Craterus with great authority. It was he who would build the great fleet, which Alexander had planned to use in his next great adventure. The ships were initially meant to be used in a grand imperial campaign against the North African Empire of Carthage. But Alexander's death and the ensuing turmoil prevented any such grandiose schemes from being carried out. Craterus, instead, decided to use this great fleet to suppress the rebellious Greeks. And the Greeks, to their credit, held their ground bravely. The Athenian admiral, a man named Euteon, had been given express orders to prevent any Macedonian attempt to force the straits. As Craterus' admiral approached, Euteon decided to make his stand at Abdios, the scene of a famous Athenian victory from the Peloponnesian War. If the Athenians could defeat the Spartans, the greatest warriors in the world, at Abdios, surely they could stand against upstart Macedonians. So, at least, Euteon must have hoped. But it was not to be. The Macedonian fleet was too numerous, too experienced, and too well led, and Euteon and his Athenians fell back in disarray. The fleet had been saved as a fighting force, and Craterus' victory was not complete, but it remained a shattering defeat for the Greek coalition nonetheless. With the Athenians unable to block the Hellespont crossing, Leonidas was able to cross into Europe with the full might of his army, a force over 20,000 strong. Now, as always, ancient authors' numerical estimates should be taken with a grain of salt, but there is no doubt that Leonidas brought far more soldiers than the Greeks could hope to match. Leonidas quickly made for Lamia, marching his men at a breakneck pace through Macedon and Thessaly, and the Greeks took notice. Antiphilus immediately ordered the siege of Lamia to be lifted, burned his camp, and sent his camp followers to a secure location, and he prepared for battle. In a move that would have impressed even Leosthenes, Antiphilus moved his forces north from Lamia before Antipater could respond. The Greeks knew that to allow their enemies to unite, their forces would spell complete disaster. And though Leonidas had the advantage in numbers, all hope was not lost. The Thessalians, who had served the coalition so well in the battle against Antipater, were to prove their worth yet again. The commander of the Greek cavalry, a Thessalian named Menon, formed his countrymen to a vanguard of 2,000 cavalry, augmented with 1,500 other Greek horsemen. Leonidas had only half as much cavalry, a disadvantage that would prove decisive. Menon and his horsemen fell upon Leonidas before he was prepared, cutting off his less numerous cavalry and forcing him into a fetid swamp. Leonidas fought brilliantly and bravely, continuing to lead his men even after suffering several wounds, until suddenly he collapsed. His injuries had proved too much, and though his followers carried him from the battlefield, he was dead before they even left. The shade of Leosthenes had been avenged. The Macedonian phalanx, leaderless, withdrew to rough ground outside of the reach of the Greek cavalry, stunned by their sudden reversal of fortunes. They, after all, were supposed to be the men who rode in and saved the day, and here they were, in need of saving themselves. The cause of Greek freedom, though battered and dented, was not dead yet. The next day, Antipater arrived. Too late to prevent Leonidas' shock defeat, but early enough to prevent the destruction of his foot soldiers. Antipater moved cautiously, however. He, of all people, knew better than to underestimate the superlative Thessalian cavalry. Despite his now vast numerical advantage over the Greeks, his cavalry remained outnumbered, and under such circumstances he would not risk a battle. More reinforcements, he decided, were needed. Like fallen Leonidas before him, Antipater turned to General Craterus, imploring him to lead his own army, yet another large force of tens of thousands, to crush the Greeks once and for all. Craterus was appalled by his old friend's death, as well as at the defeats his countrymen had suffered, and he resolved to make good on Macedon's losses as soon as possible. With a force of 11,000 infantry and, critically, 1,500 more cavalry, he marched to the Hellespont to repeat Leonidas' crossing. However, like Leonidas, he would have to reckon with the now-recovered Athenian fleet, which deployed to prevent his advance off Amorgos near the Hellespont. Sadly, the Greek naval forces were no more successful the second time. The fleet of Athens was completely destroyed. The great Athenian naval glories of old had fallen, sunken by Macedonian might, and they would never rise again. With this defeat, Antipholus and the Greeks knew that they were likely finished. In the summer of 322 BCE, Craterus crossed to Europe and united with Antipater. Together, they commanded a force of terrifying size and power. Diodorus puts the numbers at 40,000 infantry, 3,000 missile troops, and a full 5,000 cavalry. Now, the Greeks would have no advantage whatsoever. Yet, amazingly, the Greeks fought on in all the courage of their despair. Antipholus deployed his troops, a scant 25,000 infantry and 3,500 cavalry, on flat ground at the plain of Crannon. Yet again, the Greeks placed all their hopes in the Thessalian horsemen. Antipholus had arrayed the elite cavalry in a long line in front of the Greek infantry. As the Macedonian army appeared, the Thessalians charged, and incredibly carried all before them. Despite the more numerous Macedonian cavalry, the Thessalians had grown accustomed to victory, and the Macedonians fell back before their fierce onslaught. Antipater, sensing disaster, ordered his vast infantry forces to charge the Greeks' own foot soldiers. And there, the battle was decided. The Greek infantry simply could not stand before the enormous numbers of the Macedonians, and soon routed. Hundreds died in the chaos. In the aftermath, the victorious Thessalian cavalry found that their bravery was all for naught. The battle and the war were over, and Greek freedom was dead. Antipater, in the aftermath of his great victory, revenged himself upon his foes. The proud Athenian democracy was dismantled, to be replaced by an oligarchy of landed aristocrats, and Macedonian dominance over Greece was once again assured. The revolt, bold though it may have been, had failed. So I think I'll leave it there for now, with Perdiccas' regime stabilizing in the east, and the Macedonians fully in control of the Greeks once more. A note on preparation time, these episodes take a bit to prepare, obviously, but the second episode has been exceptional, even by those standards. I've been extremely busy, though. I do think I can release the episodes from here on out, hopefully every 2 or 3 weeks. So for anyone listening and enjoying this, thanks for your patience and for checking out. See you next time.